It's a beautiful day and a fine time for healing. Podcast host Randy Fine, a narcissistic abuse expert and the author of the groundbreaking book, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, and the captivating memoir, Cliff Edge Road, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being are all that matter. So put your feet up, relax, and enjoy today's show. And now, here's Randy.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. I am your show host, Randy Fine. For all of you out there who are Elvis fans, you are going to love this show. This is very different from what I usually do, but it is wellness-based. We are going to be talking about health, and it's why I agreed to do this story, but also because I think it's a very important message that we need to get out, and the author did it in such a beautiful way. New research sheds light on the story of Elvis's flawed DNA and chronic illnesses. For the first time, a research-backed explanation of why the world lost Elvis on August 16th of 1977 is offered. Today's special guest, historian and author Sally Hodel, doesn't see Elvis as a cautionary tale of self-destruction. Instead, she sees a man who struggled every day to survive. First, Elvis struggled through extreme poverty. Then he struggled through extreme fame like no one had experienced before. Finally, he struggled with disease and disorder in 9 of the 11 systems of the body. In her compelling, thought-provoking release, Elvis, Destined to Die Young, Hodel offers factual and scientific data, plus never-before-published information she gained by interviewing people who personally knew Elvis, to dive deep into his struggles with multiple chronic health conditions. And Sally's going to tell us more. Let me bring her on. Okay. Good morning, Sally, and welcome to A Fine Time for Healing.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
You are so welcome. What an amazing book you wrote. Okay, so when did your interest in Elvis Presley start?
Well, I always say that I'm lucky my childhood had a soundtrack because my dad would always play records on the weekend, and he was a big Frank Sinatra fan, and it would play Dean Martin and Jerry Lee Lewis, things like that. But he also had the Aloha album from Elvis Presley, and that was my first exposure, so I've been a fan since I was a little kid. You know, and that, of course, is 1970s Elvis. I discovered 50s Elvis on my own, and I was really hooked after that. And, you know, by the time I was 10, buying cassette tapes back then, and reading the books as they came out. So just a lifelong fan.
And that's amazing. So many people are lifelong fans, but yours started really young. Okay. And what prompted you to write a book like this, to really dive into the history of his health?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, for us lifelong fans and for those of us Elvis enthusiasts who read all the books, we're always left with questions. And that's why we keep reading it. You know, there's been so many books written about Elvis and so many written by people who knew him. And the fans will read one after another. And I think part of that is because of the contradiction in Elvis's story and then the unanswered questions. So for me, as a lifelong fan, you know, I was always kind of struck by why does Elvis die in a similar age and similar degenerative pattern of health as his mother, because his mother didn't have the stress of being Elvis. She didn't take the prescription medication Elvis took. So, you know, that was just one of those questions that was always there. I am a writer and journalist by training. I have a degree from Michigan State University. And it just got to the point in my life where I wanted to research and write about something I was passionate about. And I had been reconnected with some of my books that I had as a kid. My parents still had them. And in one of the books, it talks about how Elvis's maternal grandparents were first cousins. And, you know, it's just kind of like a light bulb moment of what if that's why there's this young death in the family. And I decided to spend 6 months just kind of reading everything I could to see if there was enough, you know, basic, easily accessible information out there. And there was. So at the end of that 6 months, I decided to really dive in and fully research it. And as a fan, as a journalist, just blown away by the way the dots connected and the way all of this made sense and the way this layer of Elvis's story really makes his entire life story make not only more sense, but it's even more amazing when, you know, you talked in the beginning about how he's always seen as a story of self-destruction, and it really is a story of survival. And when you look at it through this lens of everything he had to overcome health-wise, it's really even more of an amazing story.
It is an amazing story. And I think what people don't realize is you would think that someone like him had such a big ego, you know, and he was so self-centered, but you talk about him in the book as being just a regular guy, very nice, very kind, overly kind. And he was that way as a child, and he never really lost that kind of personality, no matter how famous he became.
Absolutely. He was a gentleman, and he was his parents' son, and they raised him to be like that. And, you know, Gladys, his mother, was interviewed in the 1950s, and she said, "I am most proud that he has grown up to be respectful." And that was, you know, they certainly succeeded at that. And there are people on movie sets, you know, that say he knew everyone's name, you know, from the lowest on the ladder to the highest, and he was respectful to everyone. There's great stories about law enforcement, who he had a great respect for. You know, he would know the names of the police officers in every town he went to, things like that. I think he related to common people. I think that's why he has the Memphis Mafia and all those guys around him that had similar Southern roots as he did for the most part. It's why he keeps his family around him. You know, at any given time, not only are a number of his relatives living at Graceland, and his grandmother always lives there. I always say, you know, what other rock and roll star takes women home to meet grandma? But grandma lived at Graceland. So, you know, he is always taking care of his family. And, you know, the other side of that, you know, when we talk about a health perspective, as you always do, it's part of what drives him is providing for his family. And it drove him from a very young age to pull his family out of poverty. And he hopes that maybe music is a way he can do that. But that continues to drive him, because not only does he pull them out of poverty, but then he has to keep them there. So when his health is compromised and his health is failing, he continues to tour even more because all of these people rely on him. And I think average people can understand that too. Like, how often is, you know, do you not feel good, but you know you have to go to work, you know you have to put food on the table. And Elvis certainly felt like that too.
And not only that, I mean, he generated probably billions of dollars, but the people who were taking care of the money were not very good with it. And so it kept going through his hands like water. I mean, you know, he could
absolutely. And Elvis wasn't very good. Elvis wasn't very good with it either, because he spent it like mad. You know, he was on the receiving end of so much generosity when he was dirt poor in Tupelo. And I think those lessons of poverty or of generosity stuck with him. So he gives away, you know, so much. And there's so many stories attached to that. He just felt like, what's the point of making all that money if you can't share it? But unfortunately, there was some bad financial planning, you know, involved along those lines as well.
Right. Your book takes us back to like the 1850s, very early, several generations before Elvis was born, so that we can see what the pattern was, where he came from and where his parents came from. And when you talk about dirt poor, I mean, you mean dirt poor. These people, you know, they may have had a radish for dinner. I mean, they were sharecroppers. I mean, they worked as sharecroppers, and they lived in the most despicable kind of places with, you know, open windows and no air and hot and cold and, you know, and they all huddled together in one room, and this is where his family came from. And he was very, very poor as a child as well, which is why you said that, you know, it was his lifelong goal to pull his parents out of poverty, because they could not seem to do it for themselves. There just was not that opportunity for them. So
absolutely. And as you said, with the early research, it's generation after generation, you know, that can't seem to pull themselves out of poverty. They let land ownership kind of go at inopportune moments. And all of that leads to Elvis being in, you know, public housing. And I write about how that defining moment of being in a rental, you know, they were renting a room in a boarding house, and they had an interview with the public housing lady who would approve them or not approve them for an apartment. And Elvis was 13. And I think, you know, he's so often, the relationship with his mother is always so romanticized and people are looking for answers there. But I think it's his relationship with poverty that gives us the answers, because in that room on that day, you know, he decided he was going to do something and only he could turn the tide, the generational tide of poverty. So when he does, he really does compromise his health and a lot of things in order to keep them at that status.
So where do you think the health issues began? Because I know there, and you say that, you know, your interest was really sparked when you found out that there were first cousins that had married back in his, you know, genetic past. And
sure.
So tell us about, you know, where this, the health issues really started, as far as you know.
Sure. Well, they're throughout the family tree and they are traceable. So his maternal grandparents are first cousins, so his mother's parents. And we see so much young death and disease in Gladys, his mother, and her siblings. So Gladys dies at age 46, you know, heart and liver related issues. Elvis dies at 42, serious heart issues. And Gladys also has three brothers, so they'd be Elvis's uncles, who die, you know, at 46 and then 48, I think, and then early 50s. So by the time you get to Elvis, when you have, you know, four people in that previous generation dying of heart, liver, lung disease between 45 and 55, and you get to Elvis, it's just not a coincidence anymore, in my opinion. So we also see disease in his grandmother. She took to her bed in, I believe, 1905, and took to her bed, they said, with tuberculosis, yet she had several children, nine children from her bed, but was diseased, you know, for the next 30 years. And it just doesn't add up, because tuberculosis was a highly contagious disease. They lived in a sharecropper's cabin. No one else caught it. No one else died from it. And then the life expectancy back then was probably 5 years at most, and she lived for 30 years. So when we see that Elvis was a carrier for alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, which is a genetic disease that affects the liver and the lungs, we can see that that's most likely what his grandmother had, and then we think it makes sense that it affected Gladys's liver, because again, it can attack the liver or the lungs. So once we can identify that in Elvis, we know it had to come from somewhere, and then we can look for evidence of it within the tree.
Okay, so with this particular genetic disorder,
mm-hmm.
Does it take two? So tell us the significance of the first cousins marrying.
Sure. So there's a number of things. You know, that's not the only ailment Elvis had, but we know that he was a carrier for it from his autopsy. So that one's a little easier to identify. But when that gene pool doubles like that, you know, your chances of inheriting bad genes is also doubled. And for the girls, they have a less chance of inheriting it. So Gladys also has three sisters who live to old age, yet Gladys dies at 46, and the three boys die very young too, because when the boys, you know, they inherit an X from mom and a Y from dad, they only get one set of those genes on the X chromosome. But a girl gets an X from mom and an X from dad, so a bad gene on one X chromosome might be replaced by a good one from the other parent. But the, you know, your odds of that are, again, it's heightened with that first cousin marriage, assuming that both of those parents, you know, both of the first cousins had the alpha-1, and then it gets doubled because they're both carriers or they're both inflicted. So Gladys is really, his mother is really the unlucky female in that family, because, again, the risk was much higher for the boys than the girls, and we see that play out in her tree.
So what else? I'm sorry, keep going. No, I want you to continue.
I was just going to say that alpha-1 is an interesting disease. It still, even today, goes undiagnosed or misdiagnosed, often as emphysema or COPD. And oftentimes, you know, because if it affects the liver, it can lead to cirrhosis. And this happened to my aunt, you know, through marriage. She had cirrhosis of the liver, and they said, well, you must be a lifelong alcoholic, and she had never drank in her life. And then it turned out she had alpha-1. So you can see how back in Gladys's day, or even before that, without the acknowledgement of this disorder, you were just automatically assumed to be an alcoholic, and that's partly what has happened to Gladys over all these years, too.
So Elvis, you know, for most of his life, he was addicted to pills, but he wasn't taking them like a drug addict. He was taking them because, first of all, he thought they were benign. And second of all, he needed it because he had so many health issues. But when did all this really start for him?
Yeah, so he starts taking medication in the 50s, probably, you know, I would say late 56 and into 57, before he goes in the military. He starts with sleeping medication because he is a lifelong insomniac. And there are certain reasons, there's only a few reasons why insomnia is present usually in young children. And one of those is ADD. And I think Elvis was probably had ADD. And of course, it wouldn't have been recognized as such back then. But, you know, his first girlfriend and several other people from the high school years and whatnot go on about how he was always fidgeting, always moving, you know, couldn't focus. So I think that was probably the case, because then he also turns, he is, Gladys had been taking dextrodrine, and then Elvis starts to take dextrodrine as well. And even today, dextrodrine is used as a treatment for ADD. So he took these things, you know, with the insomnia and the ADD, and it worked. And he finds a solution early on when he first starts to take this medication. And the thing, we also have to look at this stuff through a historical lens. And in the 1950s, dextrodrine was readily available. It was known as the housewife drug of the day. And it was prescribed for anything, you know, from depression to mood swings to weight loss to, you know, just you name it, it was prescribed. And it was really thought to have the same addiction level as caffeine. And it wasn't until the mid-1970s that they realized it was much more addictive and could become a serious problem. But Elvis does see, you know, part of the issue of, you know, connecting this cycle of poverty to his story is that when he does have access to health care, and it's not until he becomes Elvis Presley and he's famous and has money, they would never have been able to afford health care prior to that of almost any kind. And he sees this access to health care as part of his success. So he certainly sees his access to medication as part of his success. And then when he does use it to treat some of these smaller ailments and it works, you know, he kind of continues down that path.
So dextrodrine is a stimulant, but I guess if when taken by someone with ADD, it works in the opposite way.
Yep.
Like, okay,
yes.
All right. So that's why it worked for him. So that's pretty.
Yeah,
that,
I think he found relief in that, you know, in the fidgeting, he found the relief in that. And then it also obviously helped him stay awake and things like that, because he's an insomniac. So again, the initial exposure to medication worked for some real ailments that he was struggling with.
Okay. He had chronic tonsillitis from the time he was a child, which, you know, to me, thinking about him being a singer, that
yeah.
It's truly amazing that he pushed through that chronic tonsillitis that plagued him his whole life, and he still was
Absolutely.
Able to continue to sing. How did he do that?
Well, you know, there was talk of taking them out a couple times, once when he was in the Army and once later on, and he was always afraid that it would affect his singing voice. But when they looked at his tonsils later on, they had never seen such, you know, Sonny West describes them as having, you know, holes in them and whatnot, because he had battled such chronic infection with them time and time again. And that also, you know, leads us to the other disease that we know he had, which was hypogammaglobulinemia, and that's an immune system disorder. You know, Elvis's body did not make the necessary antibodies to properly fight infection. And I think we see that early on when he's battling tonsillitis as a little kid. And there's a couple stories, you know, one in particular where Vernon said his father that they might lose Elvis because his temperature was so high and they couldn't get it down. And the doctors could, you know, they had called the doctor and they did everything they could with their country remedies and all that, and they could not get the fever down. But we see him battling infections throughout his life, recurrent over and over. And especially, you know, towards the last few years when he's touring so much, as soon as he starts touring, that's even harder on his immune system, and he ends up sick, and he ends up with fever. And, you know, for quite a while there, it was thought of as, oh, Elvis is making this up to get more medication, you know, but he really was chronically ill, and it's because his immune system didn't work properly. And, of course, you know, again, think of it from a historical perspective, because today we know how important vitamin D is to a properly working immune system without this issue that he had. And Elvis lived at night. Everybody knows that he was so famous that he would live at night so he could get around better, you know, without the crowds and all that. So you know he had vitamin D deficiency, and that was not a time when you supplemented.
Incredible.
Now,
yeah. Elvis,
so something as simple as vitamin D today, you know, really greatly affected Elvis.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the first things I think doctors ask us now. It's so important that most of us take supplements, right? So I don't know if most people know that Elvis was a twin, but his twin died at birth, right? He was stillborn.
Yes.
Was he stillborn?
Yes. Yes, he was.
Okay. So Elvis was an only child. I think it's really interesting that he was a twin. It's just so, you know, so amazing.
Yeah, it is. And of course, we'll never know, you know, they were born at home and the stillborn child was born first. And then because they were so poor, he was buried in a shoebox in an unmarked grave. And we'll never know, you know, whether there were genetic complications there or not, or what might have caused that. But we can certainly speculate.
Right, exactly. So he had such a illustrative career, and it's amazing to me because I know when I don't feel well, I don't want to do anything. And with all the things that he was dealing with, he just kept pushing forward. And I guess it was because of what you said initially, that his lifelong goal was to take care of people, especially his parents.
Absolutely. And I think the medication allows him, you know, he is self-medicating after a certain point, and the medication does allow him to continue being Elvis Presley. And I know that's hard for people to understand when all you've ever heard, you know, for decades is the old rhetoric that he was abusing the medication, took too much and died. But even his death alone doesn't show evidence of a drug-induced death. It was a heart-related incident. But when we're told that over and over, it's hard to imagine something different. But I absolutely believe that, especially in the last 2 years, he could not have kept being Elvis Presley without the medication. I would compare it today to someone with Lyme disease who can't get out of bed and doesn't really know why, and it's hard to diagnose. Because we know Elvis had this immune system disorder, like you said in the beginning, disease or disorder in 9 of the 11 systems of the body. And again, it's always written off as the end result of the prescription medication problem. But we also now see that there's evidence of at least 5 of them being present prior to fame, most likely since birth, so the medication couldn't have caused them. And it's a new perspective. It's a new way to look at this, and it really does make more sense. And again, I think there's no way he could have continued being Elvis Presley those last couple of years without it. And just from the inflammation alone, you know, when he talks about how his whole body hurts. Back then, again, people thought, well, he's just trying to get more medication. But he said it over and over again in confidence to people, and we have to believe him. But just knowing how his gut didn't work, and we know how important that is today, you know, many people believe that all cancer starts with an unhealthy gut. And, you know, when that gets unbalanced, everything gets unbalanced. And Elvis had a severe, you know, digestive colon issue. He had a megacolon, and we know that constipation and all of that was a problem for him since birth. There's testimony to that, that Gladys had issues with him, you know, achieving a bowel movement from the time he was a toddler and a baby, and then there's evidence of that in high school. So lifelong problem for him, and just the inflammation all of that would have caused, you know, I can't imagine the arthritic pain and whatnot that he would have been dealing with.
It's amazing. Yeah, when he died, his spleen weighed 340 grams, whereas a normal spleen weighs 75 grams. I mean, you know, and I know his colon was huge, and it just was not functioning.
It was huge. It was not functioning, and that in itself could have killed him at any moment. You know, that could have become a toxic situation that leaked and could have, you know, killed him at any time. And again, that one is always talked about because opiates and whatnot would slow down your digestive system, and people believe that's what happened. And obviously it would not have helped someone who already had these issues. But even in 1971, when Elvis was doing the Vegas shows, and they're very active, you know, and very, like the karate moves he's kind of famous for, you know, but Elvis the Way It is one of his famous concerts that was filmed, and he's incredibly active, yet he writes what is known as the TCB oath, and it includes a lot of things, but at the end, it, you know, he asks for freedom from constipation. So even though he looks young and healthy and is so active and vibrant on stage, it is a major problem, so much so that he writes it down. And I think we all know what a stomach ache feels like for a couple days, but Elvis dealt with this his entire life and then had to perform in the way that he performed. And again, it's one of the reasons he turns to the medication, without question.
you know, this conjures up the image. My son is a fifth-year resident surgeon, and he sends us a picture of a colon that he took out of somebody, and it looks like a huge boa constrictor. It's so big around, and so, I mean, it's hard to believe that this could have been inside of somebody, but, you know, as you talk about this, I'm picturing that, and it's amazing that he could keep going on with his colon so, you know, inflamed and swollen. Stretched
and when
out,
it's inflamed and swollen and it gets enlarged like that, it doesn't function like it should. You know, we believe he probably had Hirschsprung's disease, which is from birth, and it means that the end of the colon doesn't get wired with nerves like it should, so you have a hard time, you know, pushing out waste and whatnot. And because we know it was a problem from the time he was born, you know, his Gladys's cousin, who she spent a lot of time with, is on record saying that, again, it was hard for baby and toddler Elvis to achieve a bowel movement. So for this to be a lifelong problem that was only going to get worse. And, you know, I will also say, if he was born today, you know, I'm gluten-free for a lot of reasons, but Elvis had allergic reaction to things as a kid. And we know that because his dad is on record saying, Elvis had asthma real bad. He would get so itchy and he'd scratch up and down on a tree. Well, that's not really a symptom of asthma, but I bet he was having allergic reactions to the things he ate because we know he has this bad gut. And if he was born today, he'd be dairy-free and gluten-free, you know, pretty quickly, and people would be trying to figure out what he's eating that's causing this, you know, but nobody, again, they were so poor, they ate whatever they could back then. And, of course, a high-fat diet often, you know, so things were cooked in butter, and when it's all you have to eat, you're gonna, you know, you make it taste good. So he encountered a lot of that as a child, and the colon problem from the very beginning, and it's so important to understand that, because Elvis did die in the bathroom. You know, that's unfortunately a lot of Americans, that's all they know, the younger generation, that he took too many pills and died in the bathroom. And I think that's most unfortunate given his level of contribution to our society. But I think that's also why the colon problem gets kind of extra exploited with him.
Wow. You know, he did a lot of movies, and they were kind of fluff. They weren't real deep, you know, stories or whatever. And he really despised doing those movies. He really did not. But he was pushed by the Colonel, right, to keep doing these movies. And, you know, what was the point of that?
Well, it's a two-sided thing. You know, again, this book, there are a few things that surprised me as a fan. And one of them was understanding his desire to be a provider, as we've talked about. But then I also found more of an understanding in his relationship with the Colonel. You know, I think they decide very early on, because like you said before, Elvis didn't have great financial advisors. His dad was kind of in charge of a lot of that. And they leaped, you know, so many, it would take generations to make the financial leap that family made in 1 year. So they didn't really know what to do with all that money. And when they meet the Colonel, I think Elvis decides, okay, I'm going to do the singing and you worry about the money. And that works, you know, because Elvis knows how to sing and he doesn't really want to be responsible for the kind of money that he was making very quickly once 1956 hits. And then when it comes to the movies and the Colonel is making these deals, you know, for $1 million a picture, it's hard for a poor kid to say no to $1 million to do anything. So it wasn't just all the Colonel. I mean, Elvis did get locked into these movie deals. He wanted better scripts. All of that is true. But he also, I think, from a provider standpoint, had a hard time saying no to $1 million to make another movie. But and the other problem is that, you know, they were all profitable. So and he wanted to sing less in movies. He wanted serious roles. And in the few early ones, you know, they attempt that and they didn't make as much money as the ones that had all the singing. So the fans wanted it. They were profitable. And that was another reason why those movies continued. So it's kind of a three-pronged thing. You know, they were successful. They made money. The Colonel locked them in. Elvis needed to make the money. And yes, he wanted to do something more serious and more dramatic. He never had the chance, unfortunately. But there's a handful of really good movies out of them, out of the 30-something, and you just have to look for them.
And he desperately wanted privacy, so he bought a farm, and a horse farm, and that's really where he wanted to be. He wanted to be out of the limelight. Not only that, but he wanted a wife, that was not in the limelight. He wanted, which is why he chose Priscilla, right?
Yeah, I think he had some of those traditional, you know, ideas. He was raised in a small town, Great Depression values, traditional American male, and yeah, I think he had those ideas. He was in love with Anne Margaret at one point, but he was very clear about not wanting to marry someone who was in the industry. So that was a big part of it. And yes, with Circle G was a horse ranch that he bought out in Mississippi, about, I think, maybe 20 minutes from Graceland. And he thought he could be able to go there for some respite, you know, to get away. And again, to reconnect with those roots of horseback riding and farming and, you know, all those things that he did when growing up in Tupelo. And it didn't last long. First of all, the fans found him there too, because they did. He didn't go far enough away, I guess. And the fans found him there, and it became a really expensive, you know, piece of property to hold on to. So it was just another financial drain as well.
Mm. Well, and he took everybody with him, and he bought them all horses, right?
Exactly. You know, that's the thing. It's like the whole Memphis Mafia had to go out there. Then he put 10 trailers or whatever on the property so everybody could live there. Then everybody had to have a truck, and everybody had to have a horse. So, you know, whenever Elvis did anything, he didn't do it small. He went all out. So.
Wow. Mm. Wow. What else, before we start talking about the death, what other points are important to make about his life, you know, before we really get to the part about when he died?
Yeah, well, in terms of, again, I think Elvis is he's the biggest victim in our culture of sensationalism and romanticism. You know, everybody knows who he is. Everybody knows who he is by his first name and his image alone. And that's universal around the world. Yet, you know, as recognizable as Mickey Mouse and Coca-Cola, McDonald's, all those American things, yet he was a real person and he was a human being. And I think he's gotten to this level in pop culture that he's rarely given that opportunity. So when we look at his flaws, you know, and we let in a health sense, and we look past sex, drugs, and rock and roll, you know, we let him be this historical figure and this cultural figure that he is, and then we look for understanding, you know, not just, oh, rock and roll star, drugs, and died, but when we look for understanding of, you know, the real journalistic question there is, why does Elvis turn to the prescription medication in the first place? That's never been asked before this book. It's never been examined, and there's a real answer for that. So I think by kind of stripping away that sensationalism, stripping away that pop culture image of Elvis Presley in the jumpsuits and the sideburns, and thinking about the man and understanding why he makes certain lifestyle choices, I think it's beneficial for all of us. And like we said in the beginning, it's a much better story because it's a story of survival and not self-destruction. So I would just say, before we get to his death, you know, his mother's death, understanding that came first, and that gives us a lot of answers to Elvis's death as well. Because again, when you talk about romanticism, it's always been told that Gladys, you know, Elvis is drafted, he goes into the army in 58, and the story is that Gladys, you know, just died of a broken heart because her only son was going to be going into the military, even though he had been gone touring, you know, 2 years before that. And of course, it's just a romanticized viewpoint, but the truth is that she had a cardiologist from 1955, which was not known until this book, that she had a cardiologist that early, which means, you know, from 43, 44, she would have been seeing a heart doctor, and that would have been unusual in 1956, just like it'd be unusual now for someone that young. So that is really an important aspect too, that, you know, again, it connects this through a family tree and through it not being a coincidence once Elvis is struck with these things.
It's amazing. When he met Priscilla, he met her in Germany when he was overseas in the army. Mm-hmm. And she was only 14 years old, and he was, what, 21 or something like that, in his 20s,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
You know, but you say in your book that in the South, you know, back at a certain time, this was not uncommon to marry very young women.
It was not uncommon, and it's one of those things that kind of drives me crazy just from a historical standpoint, from a journalistic standpoint, when you have all these, you know, modern day keyboard warriors that want to call Elvis a pedophile or whatever else because he likes young girls. And the truth is, I mean, the absolute truth is that girls were getting married at 14, 15, and 16 in the South in the 1950s still, and in the 1960s. Without question, it happened. You know, Dixie Locke was one of Elvis's first girlfriends, and he wanted to marry her. I think she was 15, and she had promised her mom that she would finish high school. So that was one of the reasons they broke up. He was older than her as well. But, you know, her sister had dropped out and gotten married, and she promised her mom that she wouldn't. And if you start interviewing people who went to high school with Elvis, several of the females will say, well, I only knew him until, you know, sophomore year because then I dropped out and got married. It was a very common thing to still get married that young back then. And I think what, you know, part of the reason for that is that women were not expected to go to college. They were not expected to have jobs. They were expected to graduate from high school. And most of the time, they would get married and have kids. So there wasn't really a reason to delay that.
And
so you
Lisa
were 18 and graduated from high school.
Right. And Lisa Marie was a honeymoon baby, right? She was conceived on
yes.
their honeymoon, right?
Yes.
So he wanted his wife. He wanted his family. He wanted a, you know, a normal kind of life. Was he in love with Priscilla? Because, if you know, why was he dating Anne Margaret if he was in love with Priscilla?
Well, because he was Elvis Presley.
Yeah, well,
you know, because he was Elvis Presley. He could.
Right. He could.
You know, it's kind of one of those contradictions in Elvis that's really interesting. How does this guy who is very religious, you know, very just he wants a wife who is a virgin and believes in that. He believes marriage is forever. He wants a traditional family, like you're saying. Yet he has these escapades, you know, that prove otherwise. And that's part of the juxtaposition, you know, of who he was. And I think that internal conflict for him was also very difficult because if you read about like what Natalie Wood thought of him or Rita Moreno in the 1950s when he started dating these actresses, you know, they felt like he was very inexperienced and he didn't want to do anything but kiss and read the Bible. so I think, you know, Elvis changes as the country changes because by the 70s when he is, you know, he's married in the late 60s and they're divorced, I think in 73. But that sexual revolution happens, right? And then Elvis is more comfortable with having girlfriends and all of that. And I don't think it was just Elvis. It was the country was also becoming more comfortable with all of that. So I think he evolves as the country does, going from 1950, where a lot of those things weren't acceptable, to 1970, you know, when it was.
Is that what broke up his marriage with Priscilla?
I believe it was the women, but she also, you know, had been seeing someone. I think it's just the strain of that rock and roll lifestyle, being on the go so much. You know, I think you said in the beginning that Elvis was not an egomaniac, and he wasn't. He was a good guy, but I think there is a side to being a famous person where ego, a certain level of ego, is unavoidable, and it does need to be filled, you know, whether it's with girlfriends or being on stage in front of your fans. You know, that's something that we can't really understand, but I think it is an aspect of who Elvis was.
And he was a very shy child.
He was shy. And again, even in the 70s, you know, every female that he spent time with in the 70s pretty much says the same thing. Like, you know, yes, we were together, but we would sit and read the Bible and talk about passages and talk about how they inspired us in different ways. So he was always looking for someone to connect with. And he was never a person who had like random one night stands. It would be, you know, he'd fly girlfriends in for various weekends and things like that, people he knew. So he did want to know them. And everybody was always real clear, you know, was he a womanizer? Yes, but I think everybody was clear about the situation too. He was always very honest about that, I think. And yeah, it had to be very difficult to be Priscilla, and it had to be very difficult to be married to him because of that.
And then was it Larry Geller that he met that was very much into New Age stuff? Was that Larry
mm-hmm.
Geller? Am I right? Yeah. So
yes,
he met
yes,
Larry Geller was, yeah. So he was, he introduced him to all kinds of New Age spirituality, things like that, Eastern religion and stuff like that. And Elvis just dived into that. But that was seen as a problem by his manager, right?
Yeah, and Elvis was a big reader. So, you know, before it was the New Age religion and studying different philosophies, it was history and different things like that. You know, he was always reading. He read a ton about health. When, you know, his colon problem got really bad, he asked his doctor for a book on the colon so he could understand what was going on with it. You know, he really did love to read. And, yeah, when he starts to, you know, kind of dive into all the religious stuff, some see that as a problem. I think he was curious, and he was just filling some of that, you know, curiosity. And he remained, you know, he always went back to the Bible, though, and always spent time with that, with, you know, friends and women, like I said, discussing it. But he did have a quest for knowledge, a thirst for knowledge. And in some ways, you know, he's Elvis Presley, and he can go anywhere and do anything. But in other ways, he can't, because he's so famous that maybe he's kind of just trapped reading about it and not actually experiencing some of those things.
Interesting. He loved gospel music. That's really what inspired him from childhood, right?
Absolutely. Gospel and ballads, you know, becoming the king of rock and roll, I think kind of happened a little bit by accident. He certainly had that driving rhythm and felt that music in a different way, but it did all stem from the initial gospel music that he would have heard in the Assembly of God Church. And the only Grammys he ever won were for his gospel albums.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
He was also the first person in his family to ever graduate school, wasn't he? And that education
for sure,
was very,
you know,
important to his parents.
Again, all his parents wanted, you know, was for him to graduate from high school. And we talk about the women getting married young. Not everybody graduated from high school. You know, you had to drop out. You had to work. You had to help support the family. You had to do those things in the rural South, and when you lived in poverty as well, you had to start contributing. Elvis gets a job in high school. He's working midnights, and he wants to contribute to the family, but he's falling asleep in class. So then Gladys puts an end to that. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Sorry,
what was
the
original question?
I was talking about education.
Yes. Yeah, so he's falling asleep in class, and then he has to quit his job to make sure that he graduates. But in the summer, he's, you know, trying to make money and all of that to contribute back to the family. And they wanted him to graduate, and he did. But both of his parents, you know, they say they had a third or maybe fifth grade at most education, both of his parents. So, yeah.
Wow. And what was his experience in the Army? You know, I saw – you wrote in there quickly that, you know, that somebody said that he was suffering from shell shock, which now we call PTSD. But you didn't elaborate a whole lot on that. So what was that about?
From being in the Army, I'm not sure. I don't remember.
Okay.
I'm not sure you're talking about with that, but he was depressed with, when he first entered the Army, you know, his mother. Well, so he goes to Texas for basic training, and then before he's transferred to Germany, his mother passes. So, you know, his mother passes, and then he has to get on the ship and take the voyage and go live in Germany, you know, be stationed in Germany for 18 months. And that was traumatic for him, I think, in many ways, to have to leave Graceland. But at the same time, I think it was probably very healing to kind of get some space from the home that, you know, he had shared with his mother, and just be as normal of a person as he would be again for quite some time, to kind of have that break from being Elvis Presley was probably good in the wake of his mother dying. But that was very traumatic for him, and I think he dealt with some serious depression, and there were some notes about that in the military medical files, so that might be what you're referring to.
Maybe that's what it was. What else did I want to ask you? No, I lost my train of thought. We've talked about so many things. Okay.
I'd offer.
Yeah,
go ahead.
What I wanted to ask you was, what was the deal with the colonel? Because, you know, he was a fraud, actually. He wasn't who he said he was. He was here illegally. And, you know, so how did he get this big? How was he able to accomplish this with Elvis?
It's a perfect storm, you know. It really is a perfect storm that someone with such a story as the colonel would become the manager of the most famous man to ever live. It's a fascinating story. I think it's an aspect of Elvis's story that will always have more questions than answers. I can tell you, you know, the movie was out recently, and it's not, I don't think it accurately depicts that relationship at all. And the movie makes it seem like Elvis knew that the colonel was here illegally. Elvis never knew that. That was never common knowledge until, you know, the early 80s. No one knew that the colonel was here illegally until after he passed. But again, I just think it was an agreement they had early on. I will do, you know, I do the performing, you are in charge of the money. And it worked for a long time until it didn't work, you know. Eventually Elvis wanted more control over the creative side of things. And when Elvis does take that control, and when he does, you know, record songs that they might not have the rights to, which the Colonel would insist on to make the most profit, those are some of his biggest hits. So it's really important that Elvis kind of go against the Colonel at those times. But the Colonel was also revolutionary throughout his career in many ways. So that's why I feel like it's just not a clear cut. You can't say it's all good or all bad. It's both, without question, because he merchandises Elvis in a way that had never been done before, with Elvis being on lipstick and hats and purses and wallets. And, you know, the young girls who were so gaga over Elvis at that time, they loved all that merchandise. And it was a big part of Elvis becoming so popular and so iconic. And again, with the Vegas engagements and, you know, all of that, that was very unusual. So for, you know, Elvis to make the kind of money he did and to have that presence in Las Vegas, those were all things that really hadn't been done before to the level that Elvis did them. And the Colonel was part of that.
That's amazing.
And pros and cons.
It really is amazing that he was able to do that. But you said that, you know, they were 50-50 with the money, but yet all the expenses came out of Elvis's half, right?
Yeah, after a certain point, like every part of the business is set up differently. So the recording is one thing, the movies is one thing, the concerts are another, the merchandising is another. And not all of that was 50-50. You know, the book talks about how that was split at different times. But towards the end, it was getting more and more 50-50, you know, and there is different speculation for why that was. You know, some people say that the Colonel knew that Elvis wasn't going to be making money much longer, and it was his only client, you know, and things like that. Again, I think there was some manipulation going on there, especially towards the end. I think that they should have parted ways at some point, and I'm not, you know, again, that's a whole nother, you could debate for hours about what that point should have been. And then there's other people who say that, well, there wouldn't have been an Elvis Presley without the Colonel, and I completely disagree with that, because it's not as if the Colonel stumbled upon Elvis and he wasn't famous yet. You know, Elvis was already making big waves in the South, and yes, the Colonel helped him get on TV in New York, and that helps Elvis go coast to coast and above the Mason-Dixon line, but I think Elvis was so already gaining such a following in the South by that point that anyone with connections in New York could have done that. So I completely disagree, you know, with the people who say no Colonel, no Elvis. I think someone else, you know, possibly probably more qualified, may have found Elvis and taken him where he needed to go. But I think overall it's a mistake for Elvis to stay with one manager all of that time. But again, Elvis believed in loyalty and trust, and it was, you know, he liked consistent, reliable things. So I think it would have been very difficult for Elvis and his personality to change horses midstream as well, so to speak.
Right, exactly. And that makes sense. I mean, the way that you portray his character, which I'm sure it's very accurate, because you have how many pages of references in the back?
Well, he likes that consistency. You know, that's why he has his family around him. That's why he has these guys around him. You know, he likes the consistency of being reminded who Elvis Presley, the regular guy, is. So that's why he's not always real comfortable in California. He goes to California. He likes being there, but he doesn't go to the Hollywood parties. He has his Memphis guys there to hang out with. And he likes consistency. And I think we see that in his friends and his family and the way he lives and in his management.
Amazing. You said he died in the bathroom. What was the progression in the last maybe week of his life? What was going on?
Well, he was getting ready to go on tour again. He was at Graceland, you know, longer than he had been really since he got the airplane, because the airplane, the Lisa Marie, allowed him to travel a little more easily. So, you know, instead of just staying at Graceland, he'd maybe go out to Palm Springs or, you know, Denver or wherever once he was able to do that a little bit more easily with the airplane. But that break between the last tours, he stayed at Graceland. And I don't think he was feeling good at all. I think he felt the difference. He didn't talk about it, but he stayed in his room more than usual. And there are some phone calls that he had with one of his background singers and then with one of the Memphis Mafia guys, where he just said, you know, I don't feel good. I just don't feel good. And they both said, well, cancel this upcoming tour, because they saw his health go up and down and up and down, you know, for years. And they said, cancel this upcoming tour. Take a break. You need a break. And he said, you know, I can't. Too many people rely on me. And there were two different phone calls made with that same tone in between, you know, his, from his last tour to when he was, until he passed, when he was, because he was supposed to go on to leave to go on tour the night he died, the day, you know, the day he died, and go on another, you know, 2 week or however many city tour. And of course that didn't happen. But again, when he went to bed that day, he said, you know, this is going to be the best tour ever. And he felt ready. We also know that he died in the bathroom. And I believe that the cardiac arrhythmia was caused by something known as the Valsalva maneuver, which means you're straining to go to the bathroom, or, you know, straining during childbirth, any of those things that can change blood pressure and whatnot quickly. Because we know before he went on tour, he would try so hard to empty his colon so he didn't look so bloated and fat on stage. You know, he was always concerned about his appearance on stage. So, and that comes from his doctor. So we know he was probably in the bathroom, and partly for that reason. And then that created that cardiac arrhythmia, and he died.
And you say that when the enlarged heart, let's see, liver wasn't in terrific shape but was not cause of death. When the enlarged heart was removed from Elvis's chest and held up for others in the room to view, instead of looking like a red muscle, this heart looked like brown flab. A normal heart weighs 375 grams. Elvis's heart weighed 520 grams. Wow.
Yes. And again, you know,
Ticking time bomb. He was just a ticking time bomb.
Absolutely. And we know, obviously, the medication was going to be, you know, the type of medication he took was hard on his heart as well. But when we look at his mother dying, heart and liver issue, 46, and three of his uncles, her brothers, again, exact same type of degenerative health and death of heart attack, you know, lung and liver issues. And Elvis has signs of all of that. So we don't know what that genetic heart issue was. And just the genetic liver issue could create that heart situation too. But I think there was a serious defective heart issue going on there with all in that family. And we see it play out through the tree. We don't know what that was, but we know that was a heart related death. And then we know that his heart, you know, was in that shape at the autopsy.
It amazes me. I keep thinking back to myself, like when I don't feel a little bit not good, when I'm a little off.
Yeah.
Then I don't want to do anything, you know, and it's amazing to me.
Right. Everything that he dealt with, and, you know, we haven't talked about his adrenal glands, but he burnt out his adrenal glands, you know, taking cortisol and different medications that he would take to try to get for his colon problem and other issues. And, without adrenal glands, you can't do anything, you know, and they did supplement and try to fix that and get them working again. I'm not sure they knew just how important the adrenal glands were back then. You know, there is a limit too to 1975 medical knowledge when it comes to immune system and things like that too. But he burnt out his adrenal glands. So that would have been a lifelong, you know, once you do that, you have to really, it's very easy to burn them out again. And to get them functioning properly. So just that in itself, energy-wise, would have made it very difficult to be Elvis Presley. And then along with these other issues, you know, the heart issue and the lung issue and his digestive problems and the insomnia, which is nervous system, and then, you know, about the hypogammaglobulinemia with the immune system, and then the severe arthritis pain that would have come from all of that inflammation, because all of those disorders create a lot of inflammation. And we know now that things like fibromyalgia and stuff like that can create just chronic pain, you know, throughout your body. And I think the arthritis at the level that he would have suffered from, it must have been hard to live with too.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So there's a quote at the end where Muhammad Ali says, "I don't admire nobody, but Elvis Presley was the sweetest, most humble and nicest man you'd want to know." And he had a lot of friends, high-profile friends, famous friends, right?
He did. He had good relationships, I think, with a lot of people like Muhammad Ali. He didn't necessarily hang out with a lot of famous people, like I mentioned earlier. You know, he liked his Memphis buddies and his family and friends that were comfortable to him. But he had a lot of acquaintances and, you know, friends, just not super close friends that were famous. But no matter what, there was so much respect there. You know, people always say that if you talk to anyone, you won't meet anybody who knew Elvis or who met Elvis or who talked with Elvis who had a bad thing to say about him. You know, he had met Frank Sinatra on several occasions, and Frank Sinatra had nothing but good things to say about Elvis. In the beginning, he didn't like him. You know, he thought that rock and roll was going to ruin the world, and of course, it hurt big band music, so you can understand why Frank felt that way. But came on, you know, came to have a real appreciation for Elvis and genuinely liked him. And it's not like they hung out together, but they would meet in Vegas once in a while and things like that. And people just, they really enjoyed, they appreciated, I think, how humble, how respectful, how kind Elvis was, and how he would take the time, you know, for everyone. And Sammy Davis Jr. is another one who just goes on about that.
What a fascinating story. I mean, I can hear how excited you get when you talk about this. And there's so much in this book. It's an incredible book. You did such an amazing job writing it. I mean, there's so much research that went into this. Was all of this easy to find, all of this research that, you know, going back into these generations, previous generations?
I can't say it was easy, but there were times when it was just unbelievable how the dots connected or how people helped me. You know, I ended up interviewing over 15 people who knew Elvis and making connections with people who contribute to in the Elvis world and have access to documents and things like that. And all those people were so helpful. And, you know, even like reaching out to, I wanted to talk to Gladys's cardiologist, but he's already passed. So I reached out to his daughter, and she still had access to some medical records from her dad. And she had gone on house calls with her dad. You know, first to the Audubon House and then to Graceland. So she had firsthand, you know, experience too, when no one had ever really talked to her before. So there were just a number of things like that, you know, talking to people who had access to the autopsy and people who have access to medical records. I stumbled upon some things and some people that no one had talked to before, and that was really helpful. But then other people were just, again, so giving and generous and, you know, providing some of that information that people just hadn't looked at before or talked about or pieced together in this way. Because it is a lot, and the book does cover a lot. And I know it's hard for us to kind of talk about these ailments in such a small way, because in the book it gives you more of an idea of how they're all connected, you know, to each other and then to certain parts of Elvis's life where you can see them play out more than others and things like that. So it was pretty incredible from being a fan just to see how it came together and then how it brought a new level of understanding and appreciation.
Yeah. His reputation was so exploited. And it's, you know, this, I know this comes from your heart, but I'm sure that he is absolutely smiling down on you because you told the truth, you know? He told the truth.
I appreciate that. And, you know, he was a strong American male in the 1970s, and he kept all this secret. And, you know, when you talk about health, as you often do, people are very open about it now. You have a podcast talking about it. But back then, especially in the 50s and throughout to the 70s, people didn't talk about their health. You never would have talked about constipation. You wouldn't have had commercials for yogurt on TV like you do now. It was kept very private. And he didn't want to appear weak. He wanted to be a strong American male that he was expected to be, and you know, all this got hidden because of that.
Well, it's amazing, and I'm really happy to have known him the way that you have portrayed him. I, you know, it's really, really wonderful. I, you know, I'm not a big Elvis fan. I never really was.
Yeah.
But I love reading the truth behind the man. I just think that's fantastic because it is so different than the way people perceive him.
And I appreciate you, you know, giving me the opportunity to have this conversation because, you know, I wrote the book for Elvis fans. Obviously, they're very enthusiastic to always read more, and that's important too. But I also wanted the book to reach beyond that, and it has, you know, into pop culture and just music enthusiasts. And I want Elvis to be seen as a historical figure, so I think that conversation can happen anywhere. But to have this conversation, you know, in a health setting and reach people who it might not normally reach is still so important because everyone knows who Elvis Presley is. Like, everybody knows, whether you're a fan or not. So to be able to correct some of that rhetoric in a you know, unusual setting like this one, I really appreciate that opportunity.
You have really humanized the man. So Sally, thank you. I know your book is probably doing well already, and I wish you great success with it. And I'm honored that you took the time to come on and allow me to interview you about it.
Well, thank you. It's sold out twice already. So we're into the third printing and it's just getting back in stock now, but it's on my website at elvisauthor.com and it'll be back up on Amazon probably by the end of the week too. So.
Oh, perfect. Okay, Sally. Well, thank you so much again, and have a wonderful day. This was a really amazing interview.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Take care. So we are out of time today, but if you have any comments or questions about the show that you listened to today, you can email me at loveyourlife@randyfine.com. May joy and serenity always be yours.
We hope you enjoyed today's show. Visit randyfine.com, RANDIFINE.com, and be sure to sign up to receive updates on the latest blog posts, events, and upcoming shows. Thank you for listening.